And it's going. So welcome to the fourth lecture of the Machine Learning for Greenhorse course. Well, at this point, you are not a greenhorse anymore, I would say, but the course is still named in the same way. Are there any questions at the beginning? Something you would like to know? I think everything is clear about the assignments or about the theory from the last time. It seems so. Then, without further ado, let's get to the new lecture. This time, we'll be talking about multi-class logistic regression, which means we need to start with the logistic regression we talked on the last course. So just as a quick refresh, what we did in logistic regression, we tried to learn a model for classification, and the model actually predicted not just the classes, but the conditional probabilities of the individual classes. So of the probability that the given input X is in class C0, and the probability that the given input X is in the class C1. And we did it by, oh, sorry, I still have the notes from the previous lecture, so let me open it afresh. So what we did, we still used the linear model, the one which had weights for each feature of the input, added a bias. This should actually be just B, not a capital B. I will note it, write it down, and fix it in the slides. And then we passed this real number, or whatever it was, through a function which we called a sigmoid. The sigmoid function, the blue here, returns values in range from 0 to 1. And so that we can interpret it as the probability of this specific class. And the probability of the other class is just the missing part. That's the what is missing up to one. That was it. This thing can be trained easily with the SGD. Now, the overall value, this output of the sigmoid, that's the probability. You can also look at it that the model actually predicts a distribution, so it generates a Bernoulli distribution. Right, the Bernoulli distribution is a distribution over two variables. It's parameterized by one probability, and that probability is exactly what the sigmoid function generates. The question is if this is the probability of one of the classes, is the value which is being predicted by the linear model itself, is this, does this also have some meaning? Like the output of the sigmoid is probability. So what about this value of the linear model? And it can be shown quite easily by rearranging things around that the thing which the model predicts or generates is the logarithm of the odds of the probabilities, like this. And this value, it's called a logit. You will see this, or you can see this quite often in various places. So we have got a linear model predicting logits. And then if you know that if these are logits, then you can generate the probabilities by using sigmoid and getting the probability out of it. To train it, we can just use the maximum likelihood estimation, this loss function, right? That's what we got from the maximum likelihood estimation, the negative log likelihood. And like the losses, the expectation of all the training data. We use n data, a batch, to estimate the gradient on. And once we have the estimate of the gradient, we just update the parameters of the model, and voila, that's it. Yep. And now, even if it seems that the sigmoid function is some nonlinear function, so maybe it will help us with the points which are not linearly separable, well, it's actually not true. The decision boundary is still just a linear one, even with the sigmoid activation function. So if we have points which are not linearly separable by itself, the algorithm, the logistic regression, is not much better than a perceptron algorithm. However, we can help us with feature engineering. It can be shown actually that for any data set, there exists some features computable from the input values, in such that when you use it, you project the input points to that space, to these features, that the points are linearly separable in this new space. There is like some illustration that with only two features, which are the distances from the given two points, you can actually separate these points, and this linear separation in this space amounts to this nearly circular value in this other space. So still, logistic regression cannot help us by itself automatically. However, we can still at least solve it manually by performing the manual engineering, the feature engineering. So now we've gotten to the first slide of today's lecture. The logistic regression, it in fact extends linear regression by using this linear model, which is then followed by this sigmoid function. And this is a pattern which we will see more often. So it gives rise to something called a generalized linear model. A generalized linear model is just a linear model, which is then followed by some activation function, right? So the probability of some value t can be computed by using this linear model and then passing it through this activation function. We have seen like the instances of this scheme. Well, first is the linear regression. Here the activation is none, and by none I mean its identity, right? So like none meaning it's not doing anything. The loss which we use to train the model is the mean square error, or sum of squares. The constant here doesn't really matter. The important thing is that the loss is proportional to the sum of the squares of the differences of the true values and the predictions. And the gradient, it looks like this. The gradient is the true value minus the prediction. So this is like the error what the model did, right? If predicted the correct value, then this would be zero. If it predicted plus 10, then this is plus 10. If it was then below the prediction, then this is minus 10. So this is the error what the model did. That's what we need to correct. So we need to change the weights so that it will go against this error. And then this is multiplied by x. These are the individual features. So let's say that we should have generated t, and we have predicted f slightly less. So we need to predict more, like we need to increase the output of the model. So then when we consider features, so if we have got x1 and x1 is, I don't know, a positive feature, then what we will do is we will increase the corresponding weight, right? When we increase the weight and the feature is positive, the output will also be increased. Some x might be zero. So if it's zero, well, we don't really modify the weight at all, because it wouldn't influence anything. Changing the W2 would amount for nothing. And then for some other feature, which might be, I don't know, minus 10, then what we would do is we would take the corresponding weight and then decrease it a lot, 10 times as much as for the X1. And here we are decreasing because if the value is negative, then decreasing the weight will actually make the prediction to go up, right? So this the gradient is like a straightforward thing which will immediately change the weights, so that for this one example or on this mini batch of examples, our prediction will be better. We can also add the logistic regression here, the activation of the sigmoid function. Now, in this situation, we are actually generating a distribution. We didn't generate a distribution for the linear regression, but we are doing it for the logistic regression. So the model actually predicts the distribution itself. And the loss is the negative log likelihood. The gradient is then the partial derivative of the loss, where the probability is being computed using the sigmoid, right? So it's something like minus logarithm of 1 over 1 plus e to minus f, whatever the model is computing. There is a big chance it will be terrible, right? Well, if you do the math, which you need to do for the assignment, you will find out that the gradient is actually quite nice. All these logarithms and exponent functions will cancel each other, or quite a lot, and the gradient is very analogous to the situation in the previous case. So it's still the true value, 0 or 1, minus the activation, like what the model predicts. So this is the probability. That's the probability in the Bernoulli distribution. So this is 0 or 1. This is any value in the range 0, 1. Well, I should do it like this. It is never 0 or 1 exactly. And once again, this error in the probability is then used to tell you for each feature on the input whether you should increase or decrease the corresponding weight. So that's nice that the gradient is so pretty in the end. And now we got this loss function by starting with the maximum likelihood estimation. Would it be possible to do something similar for the linear regression? Well, when I'm asking like this, then obviously it can be. So let's have a look at it. How to come up with the mean square error function using the maximum likelihood estimation. In order to use maximum likelihood estimation, you would need our model to generate a distribution, to generate probabilities. That's what we did in MLE. We tried to maximize the likelihood. However, in linear regression, we do not really generate a distribution. We just generate a value, right? If we would like to generate a distribution, then how the distribution would look like. What the distribution does is it tells us what the errors of the model look like, right? In this distribution, the mean should probably be the predicted value, right? So if the predicted value is f, then the mean of the distribution, which should be returned by the model, should probably also be f. And the question is what the errors will look like. Like the distribution will, I don't know, do something around here. The variance of the distribution, that will be the number of errors which it does. And so what we will assume that the errors which the model does have some fixed variance, and this variance doesn't depend on the value being generated. So the model makes some number of errors every verb. So that was our assumption. Once we have these assumptions, we have got these conditions like on the mean and the variance. Still, we don't know what distribution we should use. Well, probably we should just use the most general one, right? The ones which fulfills these conditions. And we talked about the maximum entropy principle, which gives us guidance and tells us that the most general distribution is the one which has got maximum entropy. So, okay, let's use the distribution with maximum entropy, which fulfills these two conditions. We also talked on the last lecture that is actually the normal distribution. Okay, so we got to the situation that the the model, compute the prediction of the linear model. It will use that as a mean, and then it will say, okay, so here is the prediction of the model, and I think there is some uncertainty around it. So if the real value is actually this one, then the model says, okay, so with probability of, I don't know, 20%, the model did the correct thing, or the model says that this real value has a probability of 20% conditioned on the predictions of the model, and the values which would be further away would have even less and less probability. Now we have a distribution, and we can apply the maximum likelihood estimation. Therefore, we will find the weights such that we will minimize the negative log likelihood of the data. This likelihood is just the probability of the normal distribution. And how does it look like? Well, there is this normalization constant at the beginning, square root of 1 over 2 times pi times sigma squared. And then it's e to the exponent. This normally you know this by x minus mu squared divided by 2 sigma squared. Like these are the letters you normally use. So this x, this output, that's the yi, right? That's the gold output. It should probably be t. And then this f, that's the model prediction, right? That's what the model gets, that generates, and that's what we use as the mean of the distribution. Now, this constant factor, or this normalization factor, doesn't really depend on w, so we can just get rid of it. Then this logarithm and this exponent will just cancel each out, so that we only have this minus or this negative sum of squares. And this minus and this minus will once again cancel each out. So we get that we want such weights which minimize this, and this is nearly the mean square error, right? This is already a sum of squares. It's divided by some constant, but once again, there is no w here, so it doesn't play the role in the minimization. And similarly to that, we can add the 1 over n factor there without changing the minimum. So we get what we used at the beginning, which was the mean square error, which means we can extend our generalized linear model stable. Now we know that in the linear regression, we actually assume that the output distribution is normal, and this mean square error is just an instance of negative log likelihood. Yeah, so that's nice that we can give a nice probability interpretation even to the regular linear regression model. Now let's extend, or are there any questions? Is this clear or something? It seems so. Great. Then let's add some more entries to this table. One thing which we need is to add or to extend the logistic regression so that it will be able to handle multiple classes. Let's assume that we have got k classes, with k being some natural number, so still a discrete number of classes, finite number of discrete classes. How can we extend the model? So generating just one output will probably not be enough when our goal will be to predict probabilities of k classes. So let's instead generate multiple outputs, then probably as much as as many as there are the classes which we want to predict into. And when we want multiple outputs, then for each output, we will have its own set of weights. So in a sense, we will have multiple linear regression models, one for each class which we want to classify into. We will collect the weights belonging to these models to a matrix. The matrix can easily be W, and the W will have as many rows Right, this W as k rows times d, which is the dimensionality of the inputs of the number of features. And we can either consider such a model to be really like some number of independent linear regression models, and we just collect the weights in one matrix. But we can actually compute the values of all of them just by using matrix multiplication. So that's one thing. We have generated more outputs, as many of them as classes. And then we would like the model to actually predict probabilities. But right now it generates all arbitrary real values. So what we will use is we will use this so-called softmax function. The softmax function computes the exponent or exponentiates the given value. So we get it a vector of values. I don't know, let's say that we have inputted 0 and 1 on the input, like a vector of these two. And so now we will compute the e to 0 and e to 1. And the values are now in the range of 0 to infinity. But we want these to be probability. So what we want them is to sum to one, right? So we will normalize them by dividing the sum of all the generated values, which means we will divide this by e to zero plus e to one, and this by e to zero plus e to one, which gives rise to this definition, right? Softmax exponentiates the values and then divide each of them by the sum of these values so that they are normalized. So it would be one over one plus e and e over 1 plus e when we get 0 and 1 on the input. This function is actually an extension of the original sigmoid function. Assume that we are processing x and 0 by softmax. So the softmax will compute e to x divided by e to x plus e to 0 for the first output, and e to 0 divided by e to x plus e to 0 for the second output. Now let's concentrate on the first one. If we divide both denominator and denominator by e to x, we get 1 over 1 plus e to 0 minus x, which is 1 over 1 plus e to minus x, which is exactly the logistic sigmoid, or just the sigmoid function. It like kind of makes sense. Imagine that in the sigmoid function, we predicted just one probability, and the second one, the probability of the event not happening or of the event not generating the class, was just 1 minus the original value, 1 minus the original value. Here, in the softmax function, we just need to put two inputs when we want to get two probabilities. So we fix one and just say, okay, let's just consider this to be zero. And the value or the weight of the first class is then predicted by the model. And the softmax function will get us sigmoid of x and 1 minus sigmoid of x as the second one. This one is actually like it's, we didn't need it for the logistic regression, so we didn't really use this full softmax function. Instead, we just got this one from the binary logistic regression. When we combine all these two improvements together, we get something which is sometimes called just a logistic regression, or multinomial logistic regression, or multi-class logistic regression, or even the maximum entropy classifier. The reason for that will be explained on the next lecture, or softmax regression. So a lot of names for this algorithm. Now, the question is whether we can give some interpretations to the values which the linear models predict. Maybe easier it's easier to start with the binary case. So in the logistic regression, we generated these sigmoid f x values, and these fx values, they were the logits, so they were the logarithm of probability of class C1 given x divided by the, well, it's likelihood actually of the class C2 given x. Right. Now imagine this softmax function in this multinomial logistic regression, we have this softmax function. Now, if we really generated two values, then it's easy to see that the value f for the class C1 corresponds to the logarithm of the class C1 given x, and fx0 corresponds to a logarithm of p c0 given x plus some constant. Plus some constant, because when we generate this logarithm of p c1, then we don't know whether our scaling factor will be correct, right? We generate some number, like a logarithm of the probability, but it's offset it by some number. This can be seen like this softmax function actually is invariant to adding some constant. So if we add plus c to this vector of inputs, then it will be added to all the places, which means we could just divide this by e to c and e to c, and it will cancel each out, so that the softmax of z plus c is just the softmax of z. So the predictions by the linear model when we will use softmax for two classes are the logarithms of the classes plus the constant. Now, how these things relate to each other? Well, assume that this fx0 is just zero, right? We won't compute the weight of the last of the classes. Instead, we will just normalize such that the probabilities will sum to one. When this is the case, it means that this c will become the minus logarithm of c0, which if we put into here, we get exactly this prediction, right? Because this plus c will subtract the logarithm of the probability of c0, which is exactly what will happen here. So with the sigmoid function, the output of the model is not overparameterized. We really generate only the probabilities which we need to, and then it means that the value which is generated needs to reflect both of these values, like the odds of the probabilities. When we use softmax for two outputs, then we generate two weights, one for all these classes, and these are logarithmic with respect to the probabilities. And then when we compute the softmax, we will generate the probabilities automatically. Now this can be then extended to all the K classes. Once again, if we generated all K outputs, it would be overparameterized, and the predictions of the model would correspond to the logarithms of the probabilities of the individual classes. And if we want them to be exact, then we can define that the last class will just get a zero. There is no need to predict for it. We can just fix it to some given value. And then the values returned by the linear part of the model for all the remaining classes would be logits similarly to the case of the logistic regression, meaning for eth output, the model predicts the logarithm of the probability of the eth class divided by the probability of the kth one, right? And that's because we are not generating, we are not predicting the kth class explicitly. Instead, it is hidden inside all these individual logits. Or we can just let the model to also predict zk, and in that case, this prediction of the model is just the logarithm of this one class. Plus some constant. Yep. So this is a bit tricky to wrap your head around, but in the end, it's not that difficult. And so we can get to training. Well, training is very similar to the normal logistic regression. We just use SGD, and we use negative log likelihood as the loss. So the only difference is that we need to compute the gradient differently. Previously, we needed to compute the logarithm of the sigmoid function. Now we need to compute the logarithm of the softmax function. And other than that, the algorithm is just the same. Yep. Now, even if, once again, even if we have a nonlinear activation function, it doesn't change the fact that the predictions, like the regions of the space where the algorithm predicts the individual classes, are still linear. It's not as simple as it was with the logistic regression. With logistic regression, we just had a hyperplane, which separated the whole spaces into two halves or in two pieces. And then in one, we predicted first class, and these other one, we predicted the second class. However, the regions are still nice. And by nice, I mean that the decision regions are always convex and therefore connected. And by convex, I mean that there are like no holes. So if there is a region for RJ, there can be some other regions inside it, and there can be some RJ somewhere here, very far away. Notably, we can show that if we have got two points for which the model predicts what same class, then all points on the line connecting these also get the same prediction, right? That's exactly saying that these regions are actually convex. So to see this, it's enough just to consider the linearity of the model. We can write any point X here connecting these two points XA and XB like a linear combination of those. So it's lambda times XA plus one minus lambda times XB. Right, and going from with lambda from 0 to 1 allows us to go through the points on this line. Now, because the model itself is linear, because it just takes the features, multiply them by the matrix of weights, then the predictions of the model are also a linear combination. So for this point, we get that the predictions are lambda times fxa and 1 minus lambda times fxb. Now, because the k was the class predicted from these weights, it means that the corresponding weight, the corresponding logit, was the largest among the others. This is also the case for XB. The kth output, the logit for the class k, was the largest among all of them. Therefore, if we take the linear combination of the logits, then in this lambda fraction, this kth class is the largest one. And with this 1 minus lambda fraction, the kth class is still the largest among the XB prediction. So it means that the kth logit is still the largest one because it's composed of two sets, and it was biggest in both of those, so it's still biggest when you sum these together, right? Formally, probably you would need to prove this by contradiction. So if the kth wouldn't be the largest of this combination, then some other would be, and that means that one of these XA or XB would have to be therefore for them this class would need to also be the largest, and that would be a contradiction. Yep. So that's what the decision regions look like. They are still linear, still still convex. Okay, now we can extend our generalized linear models table we extend it by this multi-class, multinomial logistic regression. We use softmax as the activation. Similarly as before, the distribution or the model generates a distribution, and the distribution is the categorical distribution this time. That kind of makes sense, like the categorical distribution was the one which describes the random variable with k discrete values. And similar to the Bernoulli case, it's overparametrized, so we have got, there is one more probability, we've got all k's probabilities and they sum to one, even if just getting k minus one probabilities would be enough, and the last one would be obvious from the previous ones. So we can look at the linear or logistic regression as actually generating a categorical distribution. Other than that, the training is still the same. So the loss and even the gradient is still very nice. At this point, let me have some remark with respect to the names. This model is called logistic regression, even if we use it to perform classification. So why is that? Well, in this logistic regression, we just don't generate the class. For example, in perceptron, we just predicted, oh, plus one or minus one of these classes. But with this logistic regression model, we predict the whole Bernoulli distribution, so the whole probability of actually belonging to the class. So that's why you can consider this to be a regression, because you are generating the probability itself, right? Not just the binary decision, yes or no, but even the probability of it. And the same for this multi-class logistic regression. So even if it's a classification, it's called a regression model. And this linear regression, the reason or why it's called a regression and why we call this task regression of generating a real number, it's like a historical thing. And one of the first papers where somebody was looking at some predictions, the effect of predicting some value for the given input, was a paper by I don't know who predicted the average height of, I think it was sons, given the height of fathers. And what did they came up with was, okay, so the fathers, let's say that they, this was the height of the fathers, and the height of the sons looked approximately like this. Right, so assume that there was some mean, so let me do it like this, for example. And they found out that the height of the sons is looked as in a linear relationship with respect to the original heights, and that they like tend to go back to the center, back to the medium. So they regress to the mean value. And that's why it's called a regression. If instead they would look at something else, it could have easily been called a linear progression, but we have a regression because in these specific tasks, the results were like this. By the way, at that time, people didn't really use some some square fitting and least squares or something like that. They just eyeballed the results and just like draw the lines where they thought they were the best ones. Yeah, so this was just a small detour, and now there could be many more lines added to this, or several at least lines to this generalized linear model table. I will show you just one more, and the resulting model will be called a Poisson. Poisson. I don't know how you pronounce it. I hope it's just Poisson regression. If you know and I'm not pronouncing it correctly, then by all means tell me. And with this Poisson regression, we will assume that the output of the model has a Poisson distribution. The Poisson distribution is a distribution which is useful for predicting some number of events in a fixed time frame. For example, I don't know, the number of calls to a call center in an hour, or the number of earthquakes in 10 years or something like that. In these, the events are independent on each other, right? So it's not like that the people are waiting at home and then the first calls and then the second one waits for some random time and then calls by itself. No, people are always all sitting at home and independently on each other, they just decide to call the call center. The same it's with the earthquakes where they are just like waiting in the line to get to the world, and like each of them just independently decide, oh no, it's the correct time. So if you've got events like this, then the Poisson distribution tells you the probability that some number of them will happen. So the distribution tells you, okay, the probability of k events happening given some lambda. Lambda is a parameter which is the expected number of events, or that's the rate of the events in the given time frame. Then this Poisson distribution tells you, okay, this is lambda to k divided by k factorial, and this wouldn't sum to one, so we need to add some normalization, which will be e to minus lambda, like this. So the distribution gives probability to discrete events, right? So for really in some integral number of events 0, 1, 2, you get the probability of this number of events actually happening in that specific time frame. The expectation of such distribution is lambda. That makes sense because it's a parameter, like this lambda is this expected number of events. But the interesting thing is that the variance is also lambda. And this is important difference with regard or compared to the normal distribution. In the normal distribution, in the linear regression where we assume normal distribution, the variance of errors is independent on the prediction, right? So these should have been the same. So let me draw this a bit wider. Even if independently of whether it's for 2 or whether it's for 100. But if you consider these outputs as really some number of events happening, like the some number of, I don't know, cars being rented, then the variance when the weather is, I don't know, very bad, then maybe there are more cars. Well, it's difficult to say whether more or less cars rented. So let's rent something else. Let's rent, I don't know, motorbikes. So people probably don't like renting a motorbike when the weather is bad. So when the weather is bad, there will be very little motorbikes rented, and the variance will be small. Well, just because when you rent 2 motorbikes, then what the variance can be, like 2 or something. But if the weather is nice and you are renting tens or hundreds of motorbikes, then the variance will of course be higher, because if on average you rent, I don't know, 200 motorbikes, then sometimes it will be 80, sometimes it will be 150. So this is this means that the variance will naturally be much larger. That's what the model captures very nicely. And this was actually one of the conditions or one of the assumptions we had in this linear regression model, right? We assumed that the error of the model is always the same independently on the position. But for some outputs, that's not realistic. For example, if you are modeling this number of events, then it's not like the error is the same everywhere. The error is larger when we actually assume or when we predict a larger output. So that's why this can be useful, this Poisson regression, in case we want to predict this number of events. And if we use this distribution instead of the normal distribution, then well, we can still use the same loss, negative log likelihood. And then we can, we need to choose the activation function. And if we choose the activation function of exponentiation, then the gradient will still be as nice and tame as ever. So that is actually one reason why people use this activation function. And the funny thing is that the gradient is still the same, for example, as in the normal distribution, but or in the linear regression. But with the linear regression, we just predict the value itself, while here we predict the logarithm of the value, right? The logarithm we predict, and then we exponentiate it to get the real number. We can also like change the linear regression and then compute the logarithm of the true value and generate the logarithm, but then the gradient is the subtraction of the logarithm values, right? While in the Poisson regression, the gradient is the subtraction of the real values, right? So this t is not the logarithm, it's the real value, and then this f is the logarithm, and the a, that's the real value. I will add some more slides regarding to this the distribution. I just decided to talk about it today, so that's why they weren't any more details about it in the slides. Are there any questions? Nope. Then let me continue. Right now we have talked about large number of generalized linear models. They all shared one problem or one inefficiency or one not a nice property, and that was that the input values need to have a linear effect on the output, or from the other side, the output values are linear in the input features. So for classification, if we don't have points which are linearly separable, then the model can do little or not as much as we would like to. And we, I offered you a solution, which was to use manual feature engineering to construct a better place or space where the task which we want to solve would be already linearly separable. However, there is also a better way. And the better way is a model which was suggested in the 90s, and it's called a multi-layer perceptron. The multi-layer perceptron is like an extension of all the models which we have just discussed. So if we would like to describe all the models which we talked about, then like all the generalized linear models, then we could use the following image or the following formalism. Let's say that there are some the input features x1 to xd. Then we have got some output values. These output values, that's what the model predicts. So this will probably be the probabilities, but let me just say O1 to OK. Right? For linear regression, there will be just one output. For logistic regression as well, but for classification in k-classes, we would have four outputs. And now the value of each output depends on each of the input features. So we will explicitly denote this by drawing a line between each output and each input. So we will have weights for each xi and oj. So I don't know, w, I, j connects xj and oi, right? And then we have some activation function, which we call f in this context. And that is applied on the output of the linear part of the model, right? So we could use like this as the model, and the computation in this model would, it would start by using all the input features. And then each node, the value of each node would be computed by taking the sum of all the inputs, right? So we will take the sum of all the inputs. So the inputs would be for O3, for example, they would be W3i times xi, right? So it's input features times their corresponding weights plus B3 plus bias. So we have taken all the inputs, we have multiplied the values by the weights of the edges, we have summed them together with the bias, and then we will pass them through the activation function. And that's what our models did until now. So this would just be one way how to describe all such models. And now with the multi-layer perceptron, we will add a new layer. This new layer is called a hidden layer. It's hidden because the inputs are that are the input data X. The outputs, the output layer, that's just the T, that's just the targets which we need to predict. So they are both prescribed by the data, and the activation function on output is also defined by the data, right? It's just sigmoid if it's binary classification, it's softmax if it's multi-class classification, and so on and so on. But the hidden layer, it doesn't have any template in the data, right? We have no values which this hidden layer should have or should take. It's just something completely whatever the model wants. And the same with the activation function, it can just do anything. We have no the data themselves do not prescribe any specific value for the hidden data nor for their activation function. However, we will show that this hidden layer will actually be a very important thing which will make the model to be much stronger. So generally, we have this three-layer model, the input layer, the hidden layer, and the output layer. And we connect all the input nodes to all the hidden nodes. And we'll have weight for each of these edges. And the same, we'll have weight for each of the edges between the hidden and the output layer. And when we compute the value, we will just do it as before. So for each node, we will sum all the inputs, where the inputs will be multiplied by the weight of the edges, plus the bias being added, and the activation function being performed. When we want to compute all the hidden neuron values, we can do it at the same time by using matrix matrix multiplication. So we take the vector of inputs, multiply it by the vector by the weight matrix, add the bias vector, and then pass it through the activation function, and we get the vector of the hidden layer of the hidden neurons. And then we can do the same thing and obtain the output. Similarly to the linear models as before, we either need to model bias explicitly, or we add these features with value of 1, both to the input and to the hidden units, and then we don't need to care about the biases. Instead, it's enough just to handle weights, and the biases, and one of these will behave as a bias. So regarding the activation functions, for the output layer, they are defined by the data themselves. Either there can be no specific activation function, in which case, for example, for linear regression, right? So that we will be just able to get any real number. Or if the data are binary classification, we will just use sigmoid. If we want to perform K-class classification, we will use softmax, and for Poisson regression, we would use the exponentiation. Now, for the hidden layers, it's much more interesting. For the hidden layers, first, using no activation function actually doesn't help us, because in that case, what the model looks like, well, we start with the input layer, then we do a linear transformation to the hidden layer, and then another linear transformation for the output layer. However, we can compose these two linear transformations into one, which would generate the output immediately, and also be a linear transformation, right? Because if we have put X, we multiply it by W1 at bias, and then we multiply it by W2 and add bias. Well, this is nothing else than just W2, W1 times X, right, plus W2B1 plus B2. So again, this composition would just be linear transformation. So the important or the interesting stuff will happen if we will use some non-linear activation. That's what will actually make the model non-linear. So what non-linear activations do we know? We have seen sigmoid. Sigmoid function is not bad. It starts from 0, goes to 1, right? At 0, it has got a value of 0.5. However, it could be used by a nonlinear activation, and actually people used it heavily as a nonlinear activation. However, we can do better. There are two small issues with the sigmoid activation function. The first thing is that it's non-symmetrical. Meaning it only generates positive values, and for a zero on the input, it generates a half on the output. And this is like a bit non-symmetrical, that when you start with zeros and you apply it, you just move to some other range, and you generate no negative values, which might be important maybe. For example, if you would like to model some logit using these values, then not being able to generate negative values is not very useful. Although if you iterate this sigmoid function and start with a zero, then instead of obtaining a zero, you obtain a value which converges to one. So let's make it symmetrical is a reasonably good idea. So in order to generate a symmetrical version, what we could do is we could start by taking 2 times of sigmoid x that has values between 0 and 2, and then subtract 1, right? If we subtract 1, we get function from values from minus 1 to 1, with 0 generated in 0. So it's nice, it's more symmetric. However, there is still one disadvantage. The original function, the original sigmoidal function, had a gradient of 1/4 in zero and smaller values elsewhere, right? That means it behaves as a function y is 1/4 x near zero. When we multiply it by two, this derivative increases. So this time, the derivative is two. So it behaves as y is 1/2. Sorry. So it behaves as y is 1/2 of x in this zero value. However, we will see that when we will compute the SGD. After we, surprise, surprise, we will train the model using SGD as we have most of the time until now. And in the SGD, we will use the gradient or the derivative of the sigmoid function. And as you know, when we have like a f1, f2, f3, like really a composition of functions, then there will be sigmoid and g1, g2. If you imagine that we have got really a very deep composed function, and then when we will compute the derivative of this whole function, we will be able to compute it as the derivative of the individual functions multiplied together. And it would be good if these derivatives didn't diminish, didn't vanish, didn't go to zero. So it would be more practical for the gradient of the sigmoid to be more similar to one, right? Because when it's one, it has no effect. It behaves as identity, which is a good thing. So what we will do, we will compress this function from the left and the right side in order to make it more steep, like this. So it still goes from minus one to one, but this time it has it is touching the identity in zero. We can compress it like that by compressing it two times. So we obtain this two times of sigmoid of 2x minus one. The good thing is that it behaves as identity near zero. So the gradient of it is one, very close to zero, and also it's symmetrical. So we need a name for this new function. Well, surprise, surprise, the name of such a function is hyperbolic tangent. And we didn't use any properties of this really being hyperbolic function or a tangent function or something. It's just we have actually came to the function from different perspective or from different side, but there already exists a name for such a function. So, well, why call it differently? We will just call it damage. By the way, in the original literature, people called it the symmetrical sigmoid function before someone realized this already exists in some different branch of mathematics. And since that, it's called damage. Even still, when you read papers from the end of the 90s, for example, the LSTM paper, that they don't use the tanh name, they use the symmetrical sigmoid. So that's tanh, and that's the activation function, which has been used quite a lot. However, in modern days, since 2012 or something, the people use some other activation function, which is called RELU, rectified linear unit, which just behaves like identity on positive values as zeros for negative values. And it doesn't look very much nonlinear, but even this one breaking point is enough. It provides enough nonlinearity. And from the gradient point of view, the gradient is zero everywhere for the positive values. The gradient is one for the positive value, is zero for negative value, is not defined in between. So I said that three like functions which behaves a lot like identity. So the good thing is it behaves exactly as identity, but only on the positive values, and then we get like no information from it on the negative ones. However, a good thing is that it can be computed very easily, right? There is just one if there, and the gradient can also be computed very easily. So nowadays, unless there are some other specific conditions, I would say that ReLU is just the activation function which we use, but the hyperbolic tangent is still being used sometimes. So as I said, the training is just an SGD. The interesting thing on the SGD, of course, is being able to compute the gradient. Right, we need to compute the gradient, which is the loss function with respect to all the weights. That can be really complex. So to give you some idea, assume that we have got this multi-layer perceptron. Here we can draw another node which will compute the loss function using the outputs of the module, right? This will be the negative log likelihood. Now, what we need to do is we need to compute the loss, the gradient of the loss with respect to all the parameters. And where the parameters are, well, there is the matrix U of weights and matrix V of weights. So we need to compute the loss with respect to V and the loss with respect to U. And in order to do it, we will do it gradually. We will do it step by step. And for that, we will use the chain rules of derivatives. That's one of the basic rules when you compute the derivative. If you want to compute the derivative of f gx with respect to x, then this can be computed as by computing the derivative of f with respect to g times the derivative of gx with respect to x. Here on the mathematical physical faculty, we usually formulate it a bit differently. We say that the derivative of the composed function is the derivative of the outer function times the derivative of the inner function, right? But that's the same thing. Here we just explicitly denote what does this derivative mark applies to. So on this left-hand side, we want to compute the gradient with respect to x, and we do it by computing the gradient of the f with respect to the whole parameter, to the gx, right? That's what we mean, times the gradient of the g with respect to x. So now when we want to compute the loss with respect to w, we will compute it gradually by going like step by step in the backward direction. So what we will do, we will start with this loss and compute the derivative of the loss with respect to the output of the output layer. Then we will compute the derivative of the output layer with respect to the input to the output layer, right? There can be this nonlinear activation. And then we will compute the derivative of the input to the output layer with respect to the weights V. And now when we have these three partial derivatives, if we multiply them together, we will get exactly the loss with respect to the matrix V, right? So we go in the backward direction, multiply them, we'll get to one part of the loss. Now we need to get also to the derivative of the loss with respect to U, so we need to continue. We ended up with the derivative of the loss with respect to the input to the output value. So we compute the derivative of the input to the output value to the output of the hidden layer, and the derivative of the output of the hidden layer with respect to the input of the hidden layer. Then when we are here, only the last thing remains, and that's the derivative of the input to the hidden layer with respect to the matrix V. And now once again, when we multiply this, and this, we get the gradient of the loss with respect to the weights U, right? So this is the general course of attack. This algorithm, it's called the backpropagation algorithm. Exactly, because the gradient propagates backwards from the output of the network gradually until the beginning of the network. We will have an assignment where you can try doing this manually, so you can really try how it can be done. Like, I was very free in saying things like compute the gradient with respect to V. Well, V is a matrix, so it's not really obvious. So consider this to be like an idea of when you need to do it formally, you need to make sure that you are probably computing the derivative with respect of with respect to one of the weights only, right? And I'm saying with respect to the matrix, and I mean just the partial derivatives with respect to all the weights in the matrix. So, any questions? Nope. Then then I want to talk about the reason why we are actually using MLPs. Up until now, we need to deal with these linearities, and we needed points which were linearly separable, and we needed to construct the features manually, which allowed us to do the linear separation, and so on. However, none of that is required for the MLPs, and that's formalized by this theorem. This universal approximation theorem was proven in 1989, and it says that the MLP can actually approximate any continuous function to an arbitrary degree, so to arbitrary precision. So in another way, we can train like for any given number of points, there actually exists a network which will classify them correctly, independently on whether they are linearly separable or not. It will just do it. Assuming, of course, it can be done. If you have two different classes, labels for one point, then well, nobody can do anything. But if you have only one value for each input, then it's possible to match it with any arbitrary precision. The function was originally proven for any squashing function, which was, and this by squashing function, I mean activation function on the hidden layer, which was like limited, so it was bounded. There it had some minimum, some maximum, and it was non-decreasing, right? So for example, you can imagine this this tonnage activation function. Later people even prove it for rectified linear units, so it also holds even if the function is not bounded from above. So what the theorem tells us: assume that we are given a continuous function of m variables. Then, and that it's continuous on the closed interval from 0 to 1. Also assume that somebody gave us an error, epsilon. Now the theorem states that there exists the number of neurons, n, and the weights. Let me maybe draw a picture. We have got an input. M inputs x1 to xm. Then we have got just one output and a function f, so which computes one value for these m input variables. And we say, or the theorem say, that there exists a network which has n hidden layers. There exist weights here, which are v1, v2, up until vn. And there exist weights here. So these will be W, I, J, and the biases, B, I. So there exists a network with some number of hidden layers and weights, such that when you compute the output of the network, right, this is just the formalism. So these are the linear models. When you compute the individual hidden nodes, This is the nonlinear activation, this so-called squashing function, the nonlinear activation for the hidden layers. And then these Vs are the weights of this right-hand side of the model. And this is just the sum, right? So this is the output of the model. Then there exists such a network that the prediction is to an arbitrary precision exact, or it's same to the or equal to the given function for arbitrary precision. So that's a good thing. And to show you that it actually is true, I will just sketch the proofs. I won't really go through the rigorousness of being able to say what large n will be, what the weights will be for a given epsilon. But the main idea is this. When we have a function which is continuous on a closed interval, then it can be approximated by a sequence of lines to arbitrary precision. So if you imagine this blue function, then we can generate these red segments, and they are very close to the function. And what I say is that it's possible to get to zero error by taking more and more and more segments, right? So this can be proven using some calculus things, but it makes an intuitive sense. Like if you make the lines shorter, it allows you to go closer to the function. So that's one thing. We can actually approximate a function by a sequence of lines. Now, how to describe the sequence of lines using a neural network? Well, we will use this proof actually works for this rectified linear units. So what does a neuron which uses the rectified linear unit as activation, how does it behave? Well, the output is zero at the beginning. And then once the input to the activation function gets to zero, it will start producing some output and it will be a linear function, linear activation. So it seems that we want to do this red, these red segments. So we start here, I don't know, at zeros. And now at some point, this first neuron will fire, will be used. And it will generate the line, for example, in this direction. Now we want to add a new segment. What we will do, well, we will use the second neuron for it, right? We will make it fire a bit later than the first one. And we will like produce the value, which will be then added to the output of the first one, such that the result has the required tangent, right? So it will probably would be negative. So then these two are added together, it will not go as steep up as before. Once again, when we need a new line segment, we will use new hidden unit. The bias will be set so that it will start right now at this point. Then once again, we need to go to the right, which means we need to generate some slight negative value, right? And for each k, for each one of these k segments, we will use one rectified linear unit, right? It will start whenever the segment starts, and it will add to the mix the correct amount so that when everything is summed together, the line has the correct tangent. This way, we can generate k linear segments connected to one connected to each other with a neural network with k hidden units. So once we know how many units do we want to be able to approximate the function with a given precision, we can then construct the network to actually describe this k lines connected together. And that's it. And the rest of the proof is just the technicalities of being able to compute really how much segments would we need to approximate the function to the correct correct error, and how exactly to set the weights so that these hidden units would fire at the correct times. For the squashing function, for the general squashing function phi, the proof works very similarly. First, we will notice that we can approximate the hard threshold function, that's blue one, by these squashing functions to arbitrary precision. So if we squash the function in this direction, then it will get arbitrarily close to this hard threshold function. So that's one thing. We can do hard thresholds. Once we can do hard thresholds, we can approximate the original function using the series of very narrow rectangles. In a sense, we are approximating the original function by a series of straight lines, right, like this. Once again, we can approximate any continuous function to arbitrary precision with just very short segments. Maybe we'll need a lot of them, but the more we do, the better approximation we get. And if we know what number of these straight segments do we want to use, then we will approximate these segments by the squashing function. So here there will be two sources of errors. One here because we approximate by the segments, and the second error is here because we approximate the threshold functions by the squashing ones. But we can still make this work and being able to predict, to construct a network which will describe or compute the given function with the arbitrary precision. Yep. So this theorem is the reason why people actually started using MLPs, and they were the reason for the second wave of the neural networks. It was like, oh great, the neural networks, they can solve everything, they can deal with non-linearly separable points, and that's really cool. Of course, it only works if you have enough data, right? If you don't have enough data, then you can easily overfit on the training set. And because you are doing more, you are not just computing the weights for the linear model, but even for the hidden layer, you probably need more data. But if you have enough data, then you can easily get the better results than before. One way how you can look at the MLPs is they allow you to perform feature engineering, right? We have seen in this example that when we have points which are not linearly separable, then there exists some other space where they are. And like from this perspective, you can consider the MLP to actually be like an automatic feature engineering, right? It starts with the input, then it generates the hidden layer. And then like from this part of the model, that just the regular, I don't know, logistic regression or linear regression, right? We got the output of the hidden layers. We consider them as features, and then we can solve the problem. So this first part of the model can be actually considered like an automatic feature engineering part, right? It gets the input and generates values in some other space, which is the dimensionality as the number of the hidden units. And during training, we actually train both of these parts jointly, both this part here, which will do the linear logistic regression, and the part here, which generates the features, the representation of the inputs, right? Then the hidden layer can be considered the automatically constructed feature engineering. So if we would start with these two points, two sets of points, and use an MLP, the MLP should be able to classify the points, given that we use enough hidden layer, hidden units. right? And then we could look at what transformation the network actually came up with, and we can look at the features which the network generates. Two more comments to this. First, the theorem only tells us that there exists such a network. It doesn't tell us that the SGD will actually be able to find it. It may happen that the network does exist, but SGD cannot find it from any place. There are no very general proofs about this, but people don't think this is true. So there are some new theorems saying that the SGD is actually able to find the global optimum of the data. So it is able to train the set with zero errors. So this is difficult to formulate it exactly, but generally people think that the SGD is actually able to find these networks. And the second thing, the theorem doesn't tell you how much units does the hidden layer needs. And if you consider the proof, it can be actually quite a lot, right? If you want to increase your precision or the approximation, you might need like even exponentially many hidden neurons. For example, consider that you would like to approximate the function f with n binary variables, right? So we have got f which goes from 0, 1, 2, to n, I don't know, let's say n or m. Then we can actually approximate it by using 2 to m hidden neurons, like one hidden neuron for each of the sequence of zeros and ones on the input. And generally, it won't be able, like the representation won't be able to use less or asymptotically less than exponentially many hidden neurons. And this is like just, but the thing is, this is like the counterexamples are very weird functions. So if you want to classify images or something, then maybe we don't need exponentially many hidden neurons considering the number of pixels, because, well, the images which we care about are actually quite similar to each other, right? So even if in general the bound on the number of hidden units can be large, for practical inputs, this exponential or extreme high number might not be necessary. Yep. Also, what one can conclude from the theorem that actually this feature engineering can always be done. So that for each input, for each point, there exists feature spaces where the points are actually linearly separable. We wouldn't even need that theorem. We could prove that directly. But once we have the theorem, then it needs to be the case, because if the network exists, then, well, we can consider this first part to actually be the feature engineering. Yep. So this gets me to the end of the lecture. I had some slides as a backup, but I will remove them from the presentation so that only the things which I actually talked about are there. One comment though, there are no practicals on Wednesday because there is state holiday on Wednesday. So there will still be new assignments, and I will pre-record the description of them. So me going through the assignments and telling you what you should do and maybe describing some new APA or something, then that will be just pre-recorded. It should be available on Thursday, let's say. And if you need help with something which would normally be done on the practicals, then please write on Piazza and we will give you an answer, or we can discuss or arrange some consultation or something. On the next week, once again, we will be able to do it from the practicals. So, are there any questions? Definitely. Mm-hmm. I am going. Well, there is the bias here, like for the inputs, as you mean like plus B here, right? Well, it's not really needed because if the model wants, it can like create a plus one feature here in the on the hidden layer, right? What you can do is you can say, okay, let's one of these W, I don't know, zero, B zero, and B zero, B one, which means you will get some constant value, right, for one of these hidden units, and that can then act as the bias for the overall model. Well, we are not really training anything here, right? This is just about that there exist weights such that is happening. Sorry. It wouldn't hurt us, but it can be proven without it. So in order to make the formula as simple as possible, this bias was like combined with the bias of the previous one. So it's just about the short or the small the formula or something. In practice, we use it. Like in practice, there would be this bias here, but it would be in another variable which we need to talk about. So. Yes. Yes, there could be more hidden layers. In a sense, this theorem tells us that we don't need more layers because even with just one layer, we can approximate the function input to any given precision. So people kind of assume that using more layers might make the model more efficient, meaning we might need much less weights if we actually used some higher number of hidden layers. I haven't really seen much theoretical results about that. And the theorem, of course, applies to networks with larger number of layers, but people weren't able to actually use more than one hidden layer until very recently, right? One of the like all these MLPs were being used in this like second area of neural networks in the 90s and at the beginning of this century. And nobody was actually able to successfully train networks with more than one hidden layer. It's not really true, but people weren't able to regularly use multiple hidden layers. So that's changed in 2012 or something. Well, even 2006 was some first results, but in 2012 there were some practical models introduced which actually used multiple hidden layers, and since that we have got all these deep learning wave. Yep. Yes. Yes, exactly. This is what I mean by L at the loss. And this W, that's just a vector which contains all the U11 to U and to U something. I don't know. I don't want to compute the indexes. And the V11 and V12 and so on. And there will be the biases and so on. So this is just the vector of all the weights which we have in the network, which easily like we can say, okay, generally they are like two layers, so we can imagine these first ones to be in matrix U and these ones to be in matrix V. Here we don't have explicit biases anywhere. So if they are there as well, maybe we also have B, U and BV or something. You're welcome. But when we compute the gradient, we do it gradually, right? So we don't just get the derivatives out of the blue. We like go backwards through the model. So we compute them at some steps, and then we compute some gradients which are not with respect to the weights, but with respect to the outputs of the network. So we need to go through most of the network. And once we have all of the required partial derivatives so that we have the whole gradient, then we can do the update then. Some other questions? No other questions? Then thank you very much for your attention. Enjoy the week, enjoy the free Wednesday, and enjoy also working on the assignments. And we will see each other on the next lecture on Monday. See you, bye-bye.